thank you so much. Thank you, my deepest thanks to both Elisa and Zobia for inviting me and for giving me this opportunity and for just being such gracious hosts, and to all of you for attending on this rather beautiful day now, but choosing to spend your afternoon and midnight here with me. I really appreciate your time. I'm extremely excited to share it, particularly at this forum, my work at this forum, because so much of what I'm trying to do fits in with the intellectual objectives of this forum, and I have so I'm extremely excited to share my work with you. So I'll first take you as a prelude to Westminster in 1916, where a young officer in the British MI5 sits at his desk in the War Office, looking out the window to Whitehall. He has for some time been busy coordinating with colonial and foreign offices throughout Asia and Africa on behalf of His Majesty's government in order to compile a list of newspapers and pamphlets designed to foment disturbances in India and Egypt and other further Oriental dependencies, to incite mutiny in their native armies, to foster pan-Islamism, or to create pro-German sentiment in Oriental countries, end quote. His task was an important one. With Britain and its colonies at war, it had become more urgent than ever to eradicate internal threats to the health of the empire. Thus, any publications containing native criticism of colonial rule, attacks on Western culture and values, and any denunciation of the crown were deemed pernicious and capable of jeopardizing the war effort. It was important, hence, to neutralize these threats. So every day, our officer came to his desk and made new entry into his catalog. It appeared to him that subversive propaganda was being produced across the world. Seditious groups from different parts of the British Empire published and distributed anti-colonial propaganda from all over the globe. A vast amount of this literature was obviously produced in colonial countries themselves, and much of it was impounded, confiscated, or otherwise banned. But many agitators found safer havens elsewhere to promote their rebellious causes. Egyptian and Syrian nationalists published literature in Berlin and Leipzig, as did Persian and Indian activists. Some turned to Constantinople, others utilized relative safety of Paris, Geneva, Lausanne. Indian emigre groups published material as far as San Francisco and Vancouver. And meanwhile, other East Asian anti-colonialists struggled to and wrote from Tokyo and Shanghai. Arabic and Turkish dissident writing was even being published in as far as Guatemala and in Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro particularly. The transnational networks, nature of these networks ensured that they produced a multilingual body of literature. A large number of these publications were understandably written in English and French, as well as in German, but a considerable amount of Urdu, Arabic, Persian, Turkish work was also being produced. And the collection also contained translations in Spanish, Finnish, Chinese, Portuguese, Japanese, and Tatar. So perhaps unbeknownst to him, this officer was creating a historical artifact which exemplified the collective imaginations of imperial subjects yearning to overthrow the colonial yoke and radically reconfigure their politics. This polyglot corpus contained an eclectic mix of literature, varied in form and content. There were warnings of the expansionist designs of not only the British, French, and Belgian empires, as well as the Tsarist empire. There were celebrations at the same time, though, of the German war effort and fervent propaganda in support of the Ottoman Empire. There were incitements against colonial soldiers to against the British Empire, urging colonial soldiers in the British army to revolt. Some texts meant to attack and embarrass colonial governments. Others meant to ferment and foster national consciousness. Still others imagined futures under new global powers. This noisy mix of perspectives and expressions was tied only by a mutual desire on part of their creators to disrupt the hegemony of the imperial system. And one day our officer added to his catalog a small book entitled Imperialism as the Highest State of Capitalism. And it is here that our story begins. So in this next slide, you can see I'll just go over what I do today, which is just going to go through the introduction and introduce you to the book project, and then also look at the kind of historiographical stakes of writing this, what I'm calling this called new history or global intellectual history of universal self-determination, particularly looking at it from South Asia. And in order to see that, I'm going in the third part of my talk, I'll kind of look for two scenes from the Radical Underground, which I recreate in the book. And I'll discuss that and finally go to the conclusion. So in this underground, we will meet, this is part of the reconstruction of the book, the book recreates, we will meet a diverse cast of characters, intellectuals as well as workers, publishers as well as sailors, revolutionary agents and colonial informants. Through this method, my talk, my presentation to you today will showcase both the material reality as well as the political content of this global community. Included in this cast of characters that animate the book are thinkers of colonial India, including Emmett Roy, who I'll discuss, as well as R.P. Dutt and S.A. Dang and Zafar Emmer, then others who I won't get to at the talk, but I'm happy to talk about in the Q&A. By examining their global discourse, both in practice as well as content, I will show how universal self-determination not only became the aim of national movements, but counterintuitively also the objective of radical internationalism. So let's start in the next slide, if we can have it. Just give you a brief overview of what the book project is. This book project, Nation's Descendant, tells us a new story about the emergence of global anti-colonialism and the rise of universal self-determination in the 20th century. Specifically, it asks what role the language of revolutionary internationalism in the wake of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution in Russia played in bringing about empire's formal ends. And it asks, why did radicals come to recognize the nation state as the dominant form of post-colonial state making, despite the presence of a variety of non-state or internationalist projects. As I have indicated through the vignette at the turn with I started, at the turn of the century, the global imperial order was in deep peril. And as the largest imperial power in the world, Great Britain faced mass disaffection from across various quarters of its empire, including and especially in India, but also, of course, contemporaneously in Egypt, in Ireland, and as well as in its places where it had semi-control or semi-official control by China. And it was not the only one. You had empires of all European, as well as the Ottoman Empire, and indeed the Qing Empire, with facing the prospect of a changing world. And if you can have the next slide, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin belonged to and wrote of this world, an argument that I make in the book. That Lenin's writings, he is as an intellectual and a political activist, worker, and later statesman, defined by his position in the world, a world that is primarily defined by the crisis of the imperial order and the looming question of the future of national communities. As he and his compatriots seized power in Moscow in October 1917, he announced the dawn of a new era when the empires of the world will eventually fall in the throes of the impending world revolution. My book will show that his call resonated with all sorts of imperial decriers who saw in his victory the possibility of a new world. From Rio Grande to River Ganges, anti-colonialists turned to Moscow to help realize their own political visions. And in this process, they forged an international revolutionary movement that sought universal liberation. My work draws from 25 archives across 10 cities, and it's this multilingual and multi-archival project in which I chronicle the political thought and practice of anti-colonialists from India as well as from Egypt, Iran, Turkestan, Trinidad, Kenya, as well as their compatriots across Europe and the Soviet Union. And I show in the book how they created and connected through a kind of global public sphere. The book tracks the spread of anti-imperial vocabularies across geographies through clandestine trade networks and underground channels, and argues that this process led to the emergence of a kind of global imagined community whose members, though not always proximate, shared a deep commitment to a radical restructuring of an imperial world. And particularly, I show how South Asia and India formed a critical node in this imagined community as a center, both physical as well as symbolic center of anti-colonial world making. So this historical narratives has three main purposes. And it first responds to this recent scholarly provocations, including and especially those coming from scholars here, that study decolonization in connected rather than discrete terms, and to employ the methodological tools of global history, which has grown as a field in the past 20 years, especially, to write new histories which attend to the ends of empires, the global phenomena. Now, this historiographical intervention has three intellectual objectives. First, it reappraises the origins of the refashioning of the imperial political order in the wake of the First World War. Over the last decade, several historians have highlighted that the end of the war led to a transitional movement for empires, particularly the British Empire. Many imperial policymakers were bent on and committed to a transformation of imperialism in the period following the Peace of Versailles. Some have called this an internationalization of empire. Champions of liberal internationalism, like Woodrow Wilson, William Rappard, John Smuts, sought to bring forth a new imperial order, one that would be subject to some sort of international regulation and control. And there is a rich scholarly debate regarding the philosophies underpinning these designs, as well as the consequences, both intended and unintended, of their implementation in the colonial world. However, there is another question that I ask that seems to be implicit in these historiographical discussions and that merits our attention. Why did liberal policymakers and politicians perceive the imperial system of the previous century to be in need of some type of reformation? I argue that part of the answer to this question lies in the influence of the Bolshevik Revolution on anti-colonialism in the world. Waves of anti-imperial revolution and politics had been sweeping the world since the turn of the century, if not before. But now, after 1917, not only had the bearers of a revolutionary violently overthrown an imperial government, the Tsarist government, but they had also launched a call for anti-colonialists across the world to unite. Thus, attempts to internationalize empire by liberal statesmen and their allies were conceived, at least in part, as a response to the perceived crisis of the internationalization of anti-imperialism. My second intellectual objective is in historicizing the internationalization of anti-imperialism is to trace the origins of the language and movements for universal decolonization. The relationship between socialism and decolonization is a story that has largely been associated with the global Cold War in historiography. And many scholars, of course, acknowledge the influence of socialism in the global South. However, I show that the roots of this discourse go back to this earlier period. International socialism did not influence the Third World Project and post-colonial countries only after the establishment of the Iron Curtain. On the contrary, many of the actors who came of age in the interwar period directly or indirectly participated in and contributed to the creation of the political and intellectual cultures that would facilitate and foster the growth of socialist ideals in the latter half of the 20th century as well as through the kind of third world solidarity projects that have become, that have been the focus of a lot of scholarship, especially in the past two decades. I show in the book that to many colonial actors from South Asia and across the British Empire, the Bolshevik Revolution served as a signal, a rupture, and a moment of possibility. The ideas of the revolution were not necessarily entirely new or strange, but they were a realization of an anti-imperial global vision, which many had been searching for. And my third intellectual objective, which I'm particularly keen to share with this group, is to think of South Asian as well as African Caribbean anti-colonialists, not only as itinerant revolutionaries and campaigners, but also as intellectuals, as thinkers, and as writers. My work thus presents a new intellectual history of anti-colonialism. A central proposition of my work, of the book, is that Lenin was interpreted by his colonial interlocutors in South Asia and elsewhere as a revolutionary anti-imperial thinker. I show the many ways in which anti-colonialists interpreted, built on, modified, argued, and otherwise responded to Lenin's critique of imperialism. I further argue that the rise of Marxist strands of anti-colonial thought, coupled with Soviet patronage of dissident activity in 1920s and 30s, contributed to the emergence of a new type of radical and universalist argument that challenged the legitimacy and authority of imperial rule. These arguments, unlike those in the age of revolution, centered social equality and transformation of the socioeconomic order that had sustained imperial and capitalist structures. So unlike earlier forms of revolutionary movements for self-determination, anti-colonialism in the 20th century was not just about ousting foreign powers, but also about a social transformation. So after this broad view, I can move on to sort of giving you two scenes from the underground and two parts of the book. And for that, I'll sort of start with the first being in a cold January morning in 1923, when Lady Lawrence, who was the wife of the esteemed shipping mogul Sir Walter Lawrence, received an urgent telegram from the India office at Whitehall in London. Since her husband was away from England, the corresponding officer, a man named Frederick Duke, was in need of her assistance in communicating with company management that immediately on a matter of grave significance. It had come to the attention of the company that it was increasingly evident to the authorities that shipping routes to India had become susceptible to communist infiltration. Sedition literature was being smuggled on port cities across the Indian Ocean. It was being smuggled in, as well as in Europe, in ports such as in Marseille, Hamburg, Genoa, and then trafficked across to Pondicherry, to Calcutta, to Bombay, and elsewhere. Hence, the Secretary of State for India sought to communicate with all principal Indian shipping lines touching at European ports in the hope that they may be able to stop the use of their crews for such subversion. The office of the state, of the Secretary of State, was later assured by Lady Lawrence and her husband that all captains were, in the strictest confidence, made aware of the situation, and instructions were given to take action against any insubordinate members. So we could move on. Now, in the official imagination, colonial spaces were particularly susceptible to communist incitement. Intelligence officers argued that communist literature of any variety, whether theoretical or otherwise, could prove dangerous in the hand of, quote, impressionable young minds. Moreover, colonial authorities considered controlling the spread of subversive propaganda in India as especially dangerous. They surmised the centrality of India to the Eastern policy of the Third International, the Third Communist International in Moscow, and pointed to the increased Bolshevik activity in the subcontinent, resulting in the patronage of radical groups and organizations. Second, the subcontinent proved a conduit, of course, through which political dissidents could connect with the Middle East and East Africa on the one hand, as with East Asia and Southeast Asia on the other. literary paraphernalia traveled to and from Indian ports to Java, Alexandria, Colombo, across Iran, as far as Tokyo. This made the interception of this literature in India especially imperative. So the scope of the prescription of this sort of, these sort of acts, but we can go back. The prescriptions in these laws increased every year after 1914. By the end of the Second World War in 1939, outlaw titles numbered in hundreds, and several thousands of copies of banned books and newspapers have been confiscated and stored in police depots. So we could go. And this slide gives you a look into these seized collections that contain classical works from Marx and Engels, and at others, and at other times included texts by leading communists who were living contemporaneously across the world. It was Lenin and Trotsky and Bukharin in Russia, but also Benjamin Bradley and Emil Burns right here in the UK, Clara Zetkin in Germany, Scott Nehring in the United States. The thematic of revolution was considered especially incendiary, leading to later prohibition of books such as C.R. James's World Revolution that was published in 1937. The reportage of revolutionary politics was seen so as insightful, so that books like Don Breen's famous journalistic account of the October Revolution, 10 Days That Shook the World, published in 1919, was banned. Years later, Edgar Snow's Red Star Over China, another journalistic account, and Agnes Smedley's China's Red Army Marches were likewise barred from entry. Similarly, novelists with communist sympathies were also regarded as pernicious by colonial authorities, leading to the censure of novels from around the world, including Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Ralph Fox's Storming Heaven, The Crab Canary Ship by Japanese communist author Takeshi Kobayashi, and Mulkraj Anand's Uli later was also banned. All political pamphlets and international newspapers by communists or perceived communist organizations were continuously and strictly prohibited from entry. These lists were sent out to publication houses and booksellers across Europe and particularly in Britain. Importers were given strict instruction to cooperate with the government of India and take necessary measures to control the conveyance of seditious literature into the subcontinent. Concomitantly, colonial authorities sought to keep anti-colonial literature published anywhere in India from being exported. Census stations across the Indian Ocean sought to preclude printed paraphernalia in vernacular languages from traveling abroad. And yet, the contagion of revolutionary propaganda continued to seep across colonial borders, averting the gaze of the state and slowly making its way to ship bunkers and trade union meetings, to unremarkable bookshops and to underground political gatherings, to obscure tea shops, secret hideouts, even to prison cells. And I argue that this is where the international really resided. The internationalist press was a key instrument of creating a sense of simultaneity amongst political organizers scattered across empires and working in this underground. It was a conduit through which leftist workers could converse across spaces, crossing barriers of distance and language, and a key channel for the formation of a global left, and a forum for a whole world of radical movements to talk. This period also saw the rise of what I call a kind of global public sphere, whose members may not have been physically near each other, but nonetheless consider themselves as part of an intellectual and political community connected through this underground republic of letters. Indeed, one of the most noteworthy contributions made by this international communist network was to bring various anti-colonial movements in the same analytic frame and invite readers to not only see them as connected, but also to borrow from each other and see them as signposts for the imminent collapse of capital. Within colonial spaces, the consumption of revolutionary literature contributed to the radicalizing of national and political agendas, particularly in the case of India. Questions of economic distribution, of the future of urban labor and rural peasantry, and the eradication of mass poverty increasingly became central to anti-colonial politics as we moved from 1914 to 1937. Marxist anti-colonialists challenged the efficacy of the ideas about imperial reform and imperial representation in participation, instead linking the liberation of the masses to the wholesale dismantling of the economic and political structures that have sustained empire. And as empires were understood as the penultimate manifestation of capitalist accumulation, imperial governance was seen as a form of institutionalized class exploitation. It thus followed that a post-capitalist world, a post-revolution world, was necessarily one bereft of empires. This symbiotically tied revolutionary anti-imperialism to guide a communist world revolution. So in the final scene, I would like to illustrate this by focusing on one intellectual and his thought and practice, the Bengali revolutionary M. M. Roy. So in the early 1920s, this community of international writers who I recount counted in their numbers the Bengali revolutionary socialist M. N. Roy amongst their numbers. And the next slide, you can see so I told you about arrows. So Elisa, if you click twice, so here is a picture of course with Lenin, and that the tall gentleman is M. N. Roy. Then this is at the second meeting of the Third International in 1920 in Moscow. Roy's political journey is fascinating, and I'm happy to talk more about them, and I'm sure many of you would have encountered him already. His journey took him from the underground in Calcutta in the early 20th century to San Francisco, to post-revolutionary Mexico City, and then eventually to Moscow and across Central Asia and South Asia, and intellectually moved from nationalism to socialism and communism, and then beyond in the final part of his life. And I've written about him extensively, and I'm happy to talk about him more. But right now, I want to focus on the period of his work between 1919 and 1926. He was particularly prolific in this period, along with his wife, Evelyn Roy, who we met at Stanford. And he regularly contributed, both of them, to the pages of the International Correspondence, which I showed earlier, as well as editing and publishing a number of periodicals, newspapers, and books. This chapter of Roy's career thus encapsulates the relationship for me between the radical internationalist underground, the spread of anti-colonial propaganda, and the making of a global anti-imperial imaginary. With the financial support of the Soviet government, Roy and his wife Evelyn developed a network of communist agents that would help him produce as well as disseminate political propaganda to India. In Britain, they relied on the assistance of politicians such as Chaturji Satyalava and Tom Quelch, as well as the labor activist and communist writer Charles Ashley. His compatriots included communists across Europe, such as the Irish activist James Ronnie Connolly, Humbert Droz in Switzerland, Paul Valcourtier in Paris, and in otherwise in France as well. And he, of course, collaborated with many Indian communists, including Malini Gupta, who he had known and worked with since 1918. His network featured provocateurs from Dublin to Java, from Hamburg to Aligarh. And this large network demonstrates how the Communist International enabled the global production and dissemination of anti-imperial thought. Soon thousands of copies of Roy's newspaper, The Vanguard, and as well as The Masses, was sent to Indian political emigres in England, America, Japan, Indonesia, and forwarded into the subcontinent. And in other cases, he arranged for that literature to be sent to Russia via Iran, and then Afghanistan, and then entering into from what is now Pakistan. This political work also illustrates, if we can have the next slide, the significance of maritime laborers and ship-bound workers to the history of radical internationalism. And this is a key part of what I argue in the book. The smuggling arrangements often relied on the efforts and the capacities of sailors and dock workers in European as well as in Indian ports alike. Roy collaborated with European communist chapters to organize and recruit European and Indian sailors in Rotterdam, in Hamburg, in Marseille, as well as in Liverpool and London. Concurrently, communist agents were assigned to both cities, of course, on the other side in India, in Bombay and Calcutta, to extract and extract this material from the ships and then circulate it in factories, local political organizations, student unions, trade unions, etc. Thus, the creation of this what I call the Underground Republic of Letters did not just owe to the global ethos of international communist thought, but also the organization, agitation, and solidarity of transnational maritime networks. It depended on the work of people like Essek Ali, a steward on the ship Madiana, who was caught smuggling copies of Roy's pamphlet named entitled What Do We Want from Hamburg to Calcutta. It needed people like Shamroz Khan, a greaser on a ship in Maxai, who was asked to take 100 copies of Roy's bulletin to Colombo. And it relied on Gustav Davis and Sidney Bashir, who were members of the International Seamen's Union, who aimed to illegally distribute communist literature to fellow sailors aboard a vessel of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. It is to their efforts, despite strict prohibitory measures and severe policing, that anti-colonial literature began spreading across the Indian Ocean in ever-increasing quantities. Not only the Vanguard, but copies of the international press correspondence, publications of the Red International Labor Union, and various affiliated bodies circulated amongst anti-colonial and labor circles within India. Sometimes sailors could carry them amongst their personal belongings, hiding them in food tins and boxes of soap. At others, they were discreetly crammed into inoffensive books, like novels, including War and Peace and other anthologies. These guerrilla tactics, I argue, were an important part of the subversive repertoire of methods that radical agents used to build an underground. And it is due to this system that these texts start appearing and then being translated across the Indian subcontinent and indeed in the British colonial world. So if you can have the next slide. It is using this system that Roy was able to propagate a revolutionary theory of anti-colonialism. Roy was a part of a cadre of anti-colonial intellectuals who shared a deep, a global imagining of social emancipation. At the core of his political thought was a commitment to understanding the revolutionary potential in India in historical materialist terms. For Roy, the rise of nationalism in India presented a paradox. On the one end, the mass movement was, unquote, undeniably powerful and represented, what he quoted as, a struggle of historic and to a certain extent, unprecedented character, unquote. But on the other end, a movement based on orthodox nationalism was incapable of leading to the destruction of the socioeconomic structures that bound most of the population in an endless cycle of economic destitution. In his book, India in Transition, in 1922, it was published, Roy hence sought to write a social history to lay bare the quote, deep-rooted social character of the present unrest, quote, to indicate the revolutionary trend of the growing movement, and to impress upon those concerned with the necessity of conforming to the program and tactics according to it. Roy argued that the eventual consequence of the centrifugal tendencies inherent in the international movement was the divorce of the mass movement from its bourgeois leadership. For Roy, India was now inoculated with the same revolutionary energy that affected societies across the world. In the next slide, I would. The awakening of mass energy, which has strengthened the movement for national liberation, and which alone is capable of making this movement a success, at the same time weakens the position of the bourgeois national movement. In that case, bourgeois nationalism will end in a compromise with imperial supremacy, and the liberation of India will be left to the political movement of the workers and the peasants, consciously organized and fighting on the grounds of class struggle. So I would like to sort of, this was published in 1922, and this remained the basis of his critique of the mass national movement. Now, in the last part, I just would like to offer some concluding remarks about global anti-colonialism, which was at once process and project, political practice as well as philosophy. This period marks the emergence of a rise of a kind of global anti-colonial consciousness that boasted a universalist and revolutionary ethos. Through this account, I have indexed the means through which this consciousness proliferated across borders. If the Bolshevik Revolution had galvanized revolutionary activism across the world, the symbolic and material patronage of the Soviet Union contributed to the formation of the global community of radical anti-colonialists. This marks a decisive shift, I argue, in the intellectual history of decolonization. Exemplary of this shift, the writing and political activities of someone like Emil Roy illustrates the functioning and political stakes of anti-colonialism, an anti-colonialism that was informed by Marxist-Leninism. Its adherents believed, as I mentioned, in the imminent collapse of capital, which would create the conditions of possibility for a new type of world, for a new type of post-imperial world. Their visions and conceptualization were universal in ambition, and their political practice was global in scale. Overall, my book is premised on the idea that the historic imaginations of people like Roy and those of subaltern cosmopolitans who supported him are important. They're important not only for the past visions of their future, but also they continue to matter and inform our present. And those ideas are not found in the halls of power alone, but they are found in the quiet reflections of actors known and unknown. So as the conversations on the long shadow of imperial histories abound within and without the walls of the academy, and as we try to imagine better futures in the face of historic challenges, I hope the book contributes to the collective project of uncovering and thinking through the lives and thoughts of those who in times of peril have sought to make a world anew. Thank you.